We all know it's bad. It's bad baseball. It's bad hitting. It's a bad hitting approach. The question is, though, when you're in April, how bad is it? How worried should people actually be? How defining is this month? Let's get to that topic and many more on the Minnesota Twins here on Chin Music, our baseball show at TalkNorth.com. The stars are Roy Smalley, former Twin star, current Twins broadcaster, Lavelle Neal from the Star Tribune. I'm Jim Suhan from the Star Tribune. Brandon Morton, as he has been for so many years, is our producer. We're coming to you from the Aquarius Home Services studio. Thanks to Aquarius Home Services. Thanks also to two of our newer sponsors, Your Boat Club and Minnesota Masonic Charities. Check them all out. We'll tell you more about them later. Best way to listen to this show or any show you like at TalkNorth.com. And right now, I highly recommend John Krasinski's Timberwolves show as the Wolves go into the playoff series. Best way to listen, subscribe to your favorite podcast app. It's free. It's the easiest way to listen. Let's start with Roy today. Roy, our hitting expert. Are the problems you're going through now fixable? How worried are you in the big picture about this season? And how much is this just a bad two-week stretch?
I think it's a bad two-week stretch for a lineup that's missing really key people and missing some performance from some people that we were thinking were going to be key people. So, I mean, I think the struggles of Matt Wallner, for example, that's a big oops. I mean, that's a, you know, thought might be a little bit better or quite a bit better than that potentially. Although you guys know, you know, what I've been concerned about Wallner, but it still no, you know, almost negative production there. Correa's hurt. No Royce Lewis. I think it's in its April. I'm not hitting the panic button yet. There are some bright spots. Kirilloff has looked a little bit more like Kirilloff. Julian looks like, you know, maybe he'll battle the sophomore jinx a little bit well. So I'm not overly, let's put it this way, I'm not panicking yet, but I am concerned. There are, I mean, you alluded to hitting approach, and I'm concerned a little bit about their approach, but that can be fixed and changed around as well.
Yeah, I think I'm in Roy's camp on that one. You know, and it's, I mean, Twitter's such a cesspool these days, or X, or whatever you want to call it. And Twins fans are like, you can't win a pennant and they lose one, and I'm like, you know, we got to see the big picture here, because generally, rule of thumb is you take the first 2 months of the season to see what you have, next 2 months to make adjustments, and then hopefully by then you're in position to make a run for the postseason. So we're not even a month into the season yet. The 6-11 is not good. They've had two bad losses, when they blew the lead in Detroit when they had a chance to sweep the Tigers, and then when this last game on Wednesday in Baltimore, where they worked their butts off to take a 2-1 lead and gave the lead right back the next inning. Things are clicking. They're batting 193 as a team. My blood alcohol content at times has been higher than that. So it's really bad. I'm more concerned about how the starting pitching is going to shake out, because we have two guys in rotation right now with ERAs over 8, Chris Paddock and Louis Varland. And that's got to get straightened out, because just because of injuries and a lack of depth there. In terms of the other options, you know, that could be a season-long issue. And just heard, gentlemen, Royce Lewis's injury may be longer than Father's Day. It may be more like All-Star break now. I guess he tore the quad pretty good, and that's going to be a blow to their ability to scramble back in this thing as well. So I'm not ready to sound the alarm, but, you know, there's some smoldering going on here. It's not a 5-alarm fire yet, but there's some smoldering.
Yeah, it feels so much like last year, where the lineup just looks inept and causes people to just kind of give up on the team or not want to watch the team because the hitting approach and the hitting results are so bad. I guess my concern is I do think the hitting eventually will turn around when they have people healthy. Problem is, they might not, as Lavelle just said, they might not get people healthy in short order. And unlike last year, I don't know if the rotation can carry this team. You have three guys you feel pretty good about. You have two guys who look a little lost right now. I'll go back and say it. And I first guessed this, so this is not a second guess. I felt like I understood why they didn't go out and give ridiculous long-term lucrative contracts to someone like Snell or Montgomery when that's what they're seeking. When those guys dropped their term and their prices to do Correa-like short-term deals just to kind of readjust their value, I felt like that's when the Twins could have pounced, could have put out an outstanding rotation. And by bringing one of those guys in, they also could have put Louis Varland in the bullpen, which would be helping them survive not having Yoan Duran right now. That's my first guess. Lavelle, am I out of bounds on that?
No, I don't think you are. Oh, the funny part is I ran into Louis Varland's father. His father is for Louis to be a reliever. He was like, he could pitch in the majors for 20 years.
Exactly.
but he said, but you know, Louis wants to be a starter. He thinks that's where all the money is. So that was pretty funny when the old man is telling Louis, be a reliever. But he would be lights out as a reliever. But Jim, I don't think they need relief help that much. They just sent Jorge Alcala down. I don't think he's gave up a run yet, right? Yeah, he's second on the team in WAR. Jorge Alcala is. And he got sent to St. Paul, you know, because they needed another body. And that's just where, yeah, he had thrown 8 scoreless innings out of the pen. And he's at St. Paul. That's just weird. And Justin Topo is going to be getting locked in here pretty soon. And eventually Jhoan Duran. So the bullpen is going to be in a good spot here to try to stabilize and hold things together. They're hitting 144 runners in scoring position. That reminds me a lot of last year, as Jim alluded to. And so they've got to do better in that regard. This is when I always wonder about someone like David Popkins, who's never had to get out with a hitting slump on his own in his career, and how that is affecting how other hitters on the team are kind of approaching their bats. So, but yeah, I agree. I get worried about because the pitching staff doesn't look like it's equipped to keep things tight for the offense to come breakthrough, or for the bullpen to come in and shut the door. So that's one area that I agree I'm a little nervous about.
Well, you know, starting may be where the money is, but you know where the money isn't? The money isn't in when you're not in the big leagues anymore. That's where it isn't. So I think you need to do some evaluation there. But the other thing that leaps out is that they're hitting 190, whatever you said, Lavelle, as a team. When you're hitting 190 as a team, 140 with running the scoring position is just an automatic result of that. You know, you're generally not going to hit better with runners in scoring position than you are as a team. And certainly, you know, their approaches have not been great. And so both those numbers, you know, are real. I mean, that's kind of what they, you know, what they deserve right now. I am encouraged by, I mean, Varland and Paddock have been problems so far. That's a pretty good Orioles team. Those guys can swing the bats pretty well. So I'm not going to put too much emphasis on the fact that they gave a bunch of runs to the Orioles. But what I did notice is Varland doesn't have great command of any of the pitches, but most importantly of his fastball. And I maintain that Louis Varland and Ober to some degree have to pitch inside, especially the left-hand hitters. They have got to pitch inside. And Varland has not shown the ability to come in there consistently, and so many of his straight fastballs end up down the middle. I know he's not trying to throw it down the middle. He's trying to throw it one side or the other, I suppose, or he's trying to throw it up high in the zone, but it ends up in the middle, and that's it's been proven over the last couple of years. I mean, his fastball in the middle of the zone is a home run pitch for a lot of guys. And that's what concerns me right now about Varland. With Paddock, a little bit the same thing. But what concerned me in Baltimore was not that he got knocked around by a great hitting team. It was that he didn't have any fastball and he didn't have command. I mean, his fastball is 93, and he couldn't throw his fastball where he wanted to. I mean, so much of it. I guess what I'm saying is I'm still not convinced that there's not – starting stuff there, but I'm concerned about whether there is big league starting command there. Those are two different things. And if you don't have the latter, the former doesn't matter.
So, Roy, it's been a fascinating thing to observe. They took a really poor hitting approach half of last season. Second half, they were a great offensive team with Royce Lewis and a bunch of rookies really kind of leading the way. And here we are back in April of the following year after that great offensive season. And once again, generally, if you can generalize about this, poor hitting approach, poor results. Do you have any feel for why that would happen? Is that an organizational thing? Is it a minor league preparation thing? Is it the mentality of these particular hitters? What's your theory?
I'm not really sure about that, Jim. And I'll get to that. But let's not forget that it was a bad first half offensively. Royce Lewis got hot, and particularly Max Kepler got smoking hot and carried the club. The two of those guys, for the most part, carried the club last year. So Kepler off to a really bad start and then injured. So a lot like last year. And one of the big problems, and that I've said for, I don't know, a lot of years, that I've always felt like I've always felt like Kepler was kind of the swing, the key to the lineup. And we just don't know whether he is. I mean, he's so streaky. He can go for long periods of time and just look terrible. And that's, I don't know that that's a, that's an approach thing, starting from the minor leagues. I mean, he kind of is what he is. And he's the most enigmatic, I think, of all the hitters. And so, they miss Kepler hot streaks, if and when those are going to happen again, and they miss Royce Lewis. In the meantime, from an approach standpoint, I don't know if it starts in the minor leagues, but I know that there is this mindset of pitchers are so good right now, you have to swing this way. We want to hit the ball out of the ballpark. In order to hit the ball out of the ballpark, you have to swing this way. And there's been an allowing of bad things to happen at the plate, just a fait accompli, because, when you're swinging this way against, getting ready for high fastballs at these velocities now, what can you do? And to Popkin's credit, I will say this. Last year when they were going through it, I heard him say the right kinds of things in terms of approach. He said, maybe we need to, look at a different zone, look for pitches in a different zone. We're not getting the pitches on the inside part of the plate that we're all looking for, or we're way out in front, looking for those fastballs inside. Maybe we need to move our sights out over the plate and hit the ball the other way a little bit. And he also, as a part of that, said, or maybe we just need to do a better job of looking for different pitches. If they're not going to throw you a fastball that you want, they're getting you out on these sliders, maybe we look for that. So those are the right things to say. That's what I believe, for example. It's never really been, it looked to me like people, the hitters, took any of that to heart. And I don't know if that's, if that's a Popkins and Rocco thing. You can have a meeting and say, look, this is the way you're going to swing it now, or somebody else is going to be in there trying it. Or if they do try it, but they're not capable. I mean, I really don't know the answer. All I know is after Popkin said that, it took a little while. And then the second half, the guys started swinging the bats well. And I couldn't tell whether that was they really changed their approach or it was just reverting to the mean. You swing that badly for so long, sooner or later, everybody was cold for a long time. Then everybody got hot, the second half. It's hard to win that way, especially, with a lineup, if that's the way it's going to be, especially in the playoffs. So I think that, Lavelle's point earlier about smoldering, I think there's some smoldering going on, and I think there needs to be a little bit of acknowledgement that maybe the approach has to be a little bit different than what it's been. You know, it wouldn't have taken too much to win some of the close games. It would, you know, a couple of sacrifice flies here and there at key moments, and games turn out probably very differently. And that's a change in approach. And I mean, two strikes, runner on third. Okay, quit trying to hit the ball to your pull field. Make some kind of contact. Do something different. And we're not seeing that. Obviously, we didn't see it first half of last year. So I don't know if it's system wide. I think the hitting coach knows what to say. I don't know if the hitter. I don't know where the hitters' minds are.
Well, what's your theory on why the hitting approach seems so off right now, just as it was first half of last year?
I know I go back to talking to Rocco at the end of last year, and he said he's not worried about the strikeouts as long as they hit the ball hard. And so I don't want to say it's a all or nothing, sail or fail club over there, but it's looking like one. There are times where you just need to touch the ball and have professional at bats. Everybody's going off over Byron Buxton's triple in Baltimore, because he tripled down the line. I started thinking about Roy because Buxton slid in the third easily, and Roy pointed out that Buxton's the only person he saw who was hit a ball to the left center field gap and has gotten in standing up at third, and it was all nice. But if you look at the replay, the pitch was away, and Buxton was way out in front of it trying to pull everything. And he fortunately got enough on the ball to shoot it down the left field line. When he was going good, he would focus on hitting the ball over the second baseman's head. That kept him on the ball. That stopped him from being so pull happy. And I'm wondering if we could just go back to that approach a little bit and still be able to hit the ball hard, but hitting it where it's pitched a little bit more, not trying to hit home runs, not trying to yank everything. And like I said, guys on base, good things happen when you just make contact. You don't have to make super hard contact, just make good contact. And I just wonder if this whole philosophy about hitting the crap out of the ball as hard as it can. I mean, yeah, everybody wants to be Jim Rice, no doubt. But sometimes I think it just needs to be a little more cerebral approach to these at-bats in these situations.
So be Roy Smalley.
Let me just amplify that a little bit, because it's okay to go up there looking at do big damage, even to your pull field, if one of two things happen. One way to do that is to say I'm all or nothing here till I get two strikes, because I know with two strikes I got this approach where I can touch the ball. I can still have competitive at bats with when I get to two strikes, so I can give away two strikes trying to hit the ball against or over the fence, right? But you have to have a good two strike approach if you're going to do that. The second thing is if you want to hit the ball long and hard right from the get-go, then you have to hit the pitch that you get before you get to two strikes, because with the way the Twins are right now, they're striking themselves out early in counts. This is the one thing that I will say is that Rocco and everybody else is right about how good the stuff is of big league pitching. Well, if that's true, and I think it is, then the more often you get to two strikes, the more often obviously you're going to face pitches that are unhittable with two strikes. And usually the way you get the Twins get to two strikes is swinging at a bad breaking ball because they're trying to yank a fastball, or getting a fastball and fouling it back, or swinging and missing it. And so you either have to have a great two-strike approach, or you have to not mess up the pitches that you ought to hit. And I'll add a caveat or an addition to that. You got to look for pitches that they're going to throw you too. You can't just go up there and beat your head in against the wall saying, I'm going to hit this inside fastball or left field fence, and keep swinging on the first strike one, strike two on breaking balls that you weren't looking for. I mean, you can't do that. You get two strikes, you're already done. You're out. You didn't strike out because they threw you a double breaking, screaming yellow hammer on the outside corner with two strikes. You struck out because you either chased pitches early in the count to get you to two strikes, or you got that fastball or hanging changeup or something right in the middle of the plate before two strikes, and you fouled it back. I mean, that there's really not more complicated than that.
All right, let's get some other topics, including Wallner, more pitching talk, and the passing of Dickie Betts. We talk a lot about music on this show. We'll get to that as well. I want to thank one of our newer sponsors at TalkNorth.com, Your Boat Club.
Got the winter blues? Start planning your summer. Plan on fun and get out in the water with Your Boat Club. Your Boat Club offers boat club memberships and daily rentals with access to over 40 bodies of water and over 400 brand new boats to enjoy. Whether you want to cruise on a pontoon, create waves in a speedboat, or reel in a big one on a fishing boat, Your Boat Club has got you covered. Unlimited boating memberships are available now, starting at just $1.99 a month after a one-time initiation. Life is better on the water. Find out more today at yourboatclub.com.
Chin Music is coming to you from the Aquarius Home Services Studio. We also want to thank Minnesota Masonic Charities.
When people think of the Freemasons, they often think of secret handshakes and unusual hats, and of course, the pancake breakfast. Minnesota Masonic Charities would prefer that you think about the work that they do right here in our community. Places like the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota or the Masonic Children's Hospital and the Masonic Home in Bloomington. They are just a few examples of the important work that the Freemasons support here in Minnesota. As part of the largest fraternal organization in the world, Masons have consistently answered the call when it comes to charitable needs. We look forward to learning so much more about their many programs here in the weeks to come.
All right, Roy, well, you've broken down Wallner's troubles before. I want to go more to the mental side because you've broken down the hitting mechanics very well. Kind of reminds me, a few years back, Kirilloff was really supposed to make the team out of spring training. He was supposed to be the starting first baseman or right fielder or whatever it was, but he was going to be one of their guys. And he showed up spring training and he acted nervous all spring and they just didn't think they could bring him north. And it really became, it delayed his ability to get to the big leagues and do something special. Now he's past all that now. It looks like a big league hitter, but it was kind of an unexpected development. It had to do with his emotions. I think we're seeing that out of Wallner now. He was nervous all spring about making the team. Then he gets up here and he looks nervous in the batter's box. How much do you see anxiety playing into the way he's struggling?
Well, anxiety lives with a hitter his whole career, right? I mean, it's a hard thing to do, and you go through stretches, and you have to battle, you know, the anxiety getting the better of you. But when you're really struggling like that, especially as a young player, you've lost the anxiety battle, and so it makes it. It makes it really, really hard. I saw that Corey Koski said that he has no idea when his front foot should land. And I thought that was really interesting. I think Corey's right about that. The big thing with hitters and hitting coaches right now is get your front foot down on time, whatever the timing is, you need to get it down on time, and that doesn't mean in time, it quickly. It just means on time. So that your approach into the ball is mechanically sound. I've always said that I thought, as you all know, that I thought that his open stance and then stride toward the plate is a big problem. I think it locks him up. I think it makes his swing longer. He can't get to fastballs the way he should, and therefore it's way out in front of breaking stuff because of the anxiety, because I'm working to get there. And I think it goes along with what Corey said. I think it's very difficult. And I say this as a guy that, you know, that did that a lot, stepped in toward the plate. I had to really fight that. And I think it goes along with what Corey said. I think when you start open as he is and stride toward the plate, you can't possibly get your front foot down at the appropriate time. It's just okay, here I go. Turn and stomp, you know, turn and step. And there's no like getting the foot down as you're seeing the ball well, you know, I mean, there's a real difference. And so I understand you wanted to talk about anxiety and emotion, and certainly that's a part of it. But generally speaking, if the anxiety just exacerbates all the issues with your mechanics, and it just keeps fomenting. It just keeps making it worse and worse. You know, Jim, you were just down at the Masters, and it reminds me of a golf swing. Professional golfers, they don't want to think about their swings. There's anxiety and tension, you know, as they're trying to win a tournament on the last day. And I think Rory McIlroy is a great example. Whatever is the issue that you're trying to overcome, when the anxiety level gets high, that issue is going to roar up like crazy. You know, and how many times we've seen, you know, Rory McIlroy, and I'm not picking on him, anybody. If their big miss is a pull hook to the left, then when they really need to hit a good drive and the anxiety level is there, guess what shows up? And it's like that with every golfer. They don't want to worry about their swings because they're just trying to manage their breathing and their tempo and everything and trying to win a tournament. And that's the way it is with hitters too. I mean, when you're really worried about your swing and you're getting more and more anxious, it's harder and harder to get the mechanics right.
Yep, no doubt about it. What do you see in Lavelle?
Yeah, you know, I remember covering George Brett, and Brett's big thing was, you know, I just need to see the ball and then just let my mechanics take over. And when you're in the box worrying about your mechanics, you're already like two strikes against you, you know. We saw this with Wander in spring training. They tried to address it with that step toward the plate that gets him boxed up and locked up. And after hearing what Koski had to say, it just seems to me that, you know, his time is just ridiculously off, and he probably needed to take a step back and try to get sorted out. And maybe he'll do that in St. Paul. I will point this out. Wander did hit a 438-foot homer yesterday for the Saints to dead center field. So maybe he needed to take a step back. If he starts raking down there, he'll get back here pretty quick.
In terms of injuries, obviously we've been talking about the big injuries. Lewis maybe not be back for a while. When do you expect Correa back? And is there any chance Brooks Lee gets on a path where he could help the big league team fairly soon, Lavelle?
You know, oblique strain is usually a month right off the bat, and then you got to see where you're at. So I wouldn't expect Carlos until to start swing until mid-May and maybe toward the end of May. It's too bad because he was actually swinging the bat really well when he went down, and that was a kind of a crushing blow for a team that can use every in-form hitter that it can. So I would say mid to late May for Carlos. The Royce thing's really unfortunate with the quad. The Twins never really put a hard timeline on it. They just said he was going to get shut down for a month and be re-evaluated. So I'm not going to come down on them too hard for not being totally transparent, but they still could have said that the injury like this takes multiple months, and that would have, you know, prepared fans for a lengthy absence. I was thinking Father's Day, and now I've been told I'm a little short on that prediction, and that's a huge blow. Don't forget, Rocco said Royce was probably his best option at cleanup hitter. Yep. And, you know, how can you craft a lineup without having a run producer in the middle of it? And if Royce is that guy, which is amazing for someone with his lack of experience, that says a lot about the rest of the lineup. So that could really handcuff the Twins going forward here. Brooks Lee, I gotta imagine when he gets online with St. Paul, he'll probably need a couple weeks to prove that he can swing the bat and be a proficient at the plate before he gets a call up. But I mean, the way things are going now, I'm guessing we'll see Brooks Lee by June. You know, as long as he can stay, once he gets healthy, to stay healthy and put some at bats together. So anyone, anyone in organization, in the high levels of organization, has shown the ability to put the bat on the ball. I think he's going to have to be considered for a call up here.
Yep. All right. Hey, let's get to, we like talking about music on this show. We do it a lot in the off season. I think we've painted enough of a picture where the Twins are right now. Dickie Betts passing away. And Roy, you and I think we've had this conversation before. What's amazing about some of the great artists in American history is you think about their influence and you feel like they were like out there just touring and producing albums for 30 years. The Allman Brothers had a very small window of time when they're all together, and they kind of created their own niche and dominated that niche.
They absolutely did create their niche and their sound. For the most part, you know, it was just the tragic death of Duane Allman early on that short-circuited the Allman Brothers really having, you know, staying power. As good as Greg Allman is, on, you know, someone I read somewhere, Greg Allman is the best white blues singer ever. That might be true. That might be true. And Dickie Betts, one of the really great guitarists. When they lost Duane Allman, it just became different. Even though with Dickie Betts, you know, they're writing, you know, Jessica, that great instrumental that they did, Ramblin' Man, you know, I mean, that was great stuff, great commercial hits and all that. It wasn't the same band, and it was, you know, after Duane Allman. Having said that, all these years, this is a sad time for me because, as you know, I was a gigantic Allman Brothers fan since they first came out back in the 70s when I first started listening to them, all the way up until, you know, more recently. And I was a big Dickie Betts fan. You know, he wrote Blue Sky. He wrote the beautiful Melissa. In addition to those, and that's Duane Allman was there too, and he's playing great guitar right along. Duane Allman, one of the best guitarists ever. So this is a sad day for me. I think about how many times I've listened to Dickie Betts do Blue Sky and Melissa. You know, it's measured in the, I don't know, it's measured in the thousands of times. And he was a wonderful, wonderful guitarist and bandmate, I think.
No doubt about it.
It wasn't hard to come across Allman Brothers song, especially when Ramblin' Man was out. I didn't really know the depth of their enormity of their success until, you know, as I got older. They like writing songs about women, Jessica, Melissa. I think there was an Elizabeth in there somewhere too. But
in memory of Elizabeth Reed, one of the greatest,
I do have Greg Allman's Low Country Blues, and I thought that was outstanding. So I can get the whole argument of the best white blues singer ever. That was a damn fine album. I may actually throw it in sometime this weekend. So, when I heard of Dickie Betts passing away, I started thinking about just how big the Allman Brothers were, how they kind of redefined the genre of music during their time.
And I would highly recommend the documentary Muscle Shoals. It's a great documentary about a great subject to begin with, but it also shows you Duane Allman and what he was like when he was a studio musician before he joined or helped form the Allman Brothers. Just great stuff as well. All right, gentlemen, good stuff. I hope the Twins give us something different to talk about next week. If not, we'll continue breaking down what needs to be broken down here at Chin Music. From the Aquarius Home Services Studios, thanks again to Your Boat Club, Minnesota Masonic Charities, our producer, Brandon Morton. For Roy Smalley and Lavelle Neal, I'm Jim Suhan, and we will talk to you next week.